Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, and while you're there, rate and review us. Let us know how we're doing. Today, during School Choice Week, near the very end of the seventh year of National School Choice Week, we are talking with Lisa Snell. She's the Director of Education Policy and Research at Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast, as well as Reason Magazine, Reason.com, and Reason TV. Lisa, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. Give us a shape, or give me the size and shape of school choice now. It's, you know, we're 7 years into National School Choice Week, which is a national kind of set of events celebrating all forms of school choice. It started with, 150 events nationally. Now it's something like 20,000 events around the country. Is that because of school choice? What's going on with school choice over the past 20 years or so?
Right. I mean, we've seen there's good news and there's bad news. We've seen a tremendous amount of growth in school choice, especially in the last decade or so. And, you know, that's in all different kinds of choice. But just to give you a sample, you know, we're up to close to 60 tax credit and school voucher programs across the country. And, you know, we have places like Florida. The Supreme Court just decided that the largest program, which is a tax credit program with 100,000 kids, is constitutional in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We have places like Indiana, where they have basically an unlimited voucher program that has a very high income level. So it's not mean tested just for the lowest, most disadvantaged kids. And, you know, they have thousands of kids. I think it's close to like 25,000 kids or something in Indiana that are using vouchers.
And with those vouchers, they can go to any public school or any private school or any school.
Right. So Basically the money is attached to them and it follows them to any kind of choice. And so that includes all different kinds of private schools, and they can, of course, stay in their public school or go to a charter school. And, you know, so the kinds of programs, education savings accounts, tax credits, the charter school movement just in the last 5 years has shown more than 60% growth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's now close to 3 million kids in charter schools. There's close to 7,000 charter schools in the country. And we're at about 6% of the kids in the United States are in charter schools.
And that's up from literally 0%. About 25 years ago, because charter schools didn't
exist. That's right.
Exist.
I mean, when I was coming up in school at the Cato Institute, we had to do this project, and charter schools, there were no charter schools, but we had that as our reform. And I can remember that the folks at Cato were very skeptical about charter schools. And David Bowes in particular said, you know, this will never happen. And it turns out, I think the great advantage of charter schools is that it's such a local reform. So you don't have to convince a whole state to pass a voucher initiative. You just have to get a group of families in one very specific location that need a change. And it turns out that that's a lot easier to do than trying to get something done.
And a charter school, for those of us who are, have been in a coma, quite honestly, for the past 20 years, or certainly the past 2 weeks, the Secretary of Education nominee under Donald Trump, Betsy DeVos, has been getting kind of beat up in the press and in her confirmation hearings. Define what a charter school is.
So a charter school basically just has a contract for both academic performance and financial stability with a government authorizer, and they're freed theoretically from a lot of regulation around public schools, although they still have to follow like special education law at the federal level. So they're not completely free. It's not, you know, they often call charter schools the Wild West. It's not like they can do whatever they want, but they are free from a lot of like district constraints and collective bargaining.
So it's a publicly funded school
that gets a percentage
of the typical per pupil amount and then is able to, I mean, they flourish or they fail by the number of students that they attract.
That's right. And, you know, one of the advantages of charter schools is that they can close if they are bad actors. And, you know, they like to have cover stories about failing charter schools, but they never mention the public school down the street that has been doing worse for decades. you know, and it's a feature, not a bug, that charter schools can close if they don't meet their, you know, contractual duties. And Betsy DeVos in particular has been really dinged about the performance of charter schools in Detroit, but it turns out, you know, they're outscoring the public schools by every bar. And one of the theories about charter schools, and this is true both in New Orleans and in Arizona, that have very highly successful charter schools with high scores, is the more charter schools you open, a certain amount of them will fail. Mm-hmm. But do you constrain the number of schools on the front end, or do you let a lot of schools flourish? And then you have a lot of good capacity. And that's already starting to happen in Detroit, yeah, as schools that aren't doing as well close, even charter schools. And so, right, you know, to the extent that charter schools have taken over market share in places like Arizona or New Orleans, over time, they do, you know, the market sorts itself out, and parents do end up flocking to the schools with higher performance.
So let's talk a little bit about Betsy DeVos and Detroit schools, because that is, you know, that's kind of ground zero where, you know, Detroit is a bankrupt city. Detroit has seen, you know, a population exodus, which actually started in 1950. That's when it peaked in population, but it continues to lose people. The schools are terrible. You hear a lot of defenders of the educational status quo saying, you know, one of the problems, or, you know, it's always charter schools are terrible. You know, they really don't do anything. They're all run by flim-flam artists, and they drain money out of the public schools. You say, you know, and of course, Betsy DeVos is a big supporter of school choice in general, including charter schools and more radical proposals. But what's happened to the Detroit schools? I mean, have charter schools and other programs of choice, is that why the conventional public schools in Detroit are failing?
I mean, you can't blame it on the exodus. I don't, you know, that's a symptom of the failure, right? Mm-hmm. So I think they have the argument backwards. People, you know, in Michigan, they have a very robust open enrollment system that allows students to go to neighboring districts. So the majority of kids that have left the Detroit schools have actually gone to competing public schools, not charter schools, in other districts that are in the suburbs because of their open enrollment program. So you have actual public schools saying, we have a better program, bring your kids here. And Detroit kids went there. And then you also have a lot of charter schools in Detroit. And, you know, the thing is that when you use anecdotal evidence, you can always find stories of some kids that aren't doing well in either system.
Right.
But a lot of the coverage, say, in the New York Times has really focused on not so much the data, but finding these very sympathetic stories. Now, could you find terrible sympathetic stories in the public schools as well? Of course, they just didn't do that. And so, you know, when you look at the aggregate of how the charter schools are doing, and especially the data from the last couple of years, those kids are far outscoring the public school students. But the problem is that Detroit is at such a low bar, you know, on the NAEP, which is the national benchmark, they're scoring 50th. So even if you make improvement, there's still a long way to go in Detroit. And, you know, the focus has to be on, if schools aren't making improvement, whether they're charter or public schools, those kids should be able to exit and take their money to some higher performing school somewhere else.
Well, and, you know, let's talk about a place where that has happened, you know, at literally at 100%. I know that you've done a lot of work, a lot of research and analysis of the New Orleans school district. And that is a place where there's literally 100% of the kids in that program or in that school district choose what school they end up at. Talk about that. And what is, you know, what is working there? Because now, you know, and it's interesting over this past year, which seems to be a sign that school choice is really growing, you know, that there's a lot of public pushback on charter schools and on other school choice programs. But what's going on in New Orleans, and what are the lessons that everybody should be learning from New Orleans?
You know, so New Orleans really started from ground zero or scratch when they had the hurricane in 2005, and they basically, you know, the public school system was completely dysfunctional because of both property damage and because you know, everyone had to leave and the contracts were voided. And so they basically had a system where the state had taken over the district and contracted out schools to various providers. And in the beginning, there were still some public schools, but over time, both the Orleans Parish public school district that is left and the state school district has become 100% charter. So there's no traditional public schools that are not on contract left in the city of New Orleans. And in terms of every indicator, whether you look at student achievement or graduation rates or college attendance or improvement on the ACT, across a broad range of data points, New Orleans has been on an upward trajectory. And the school has a A through F rating system in the state. And before the charter school movement in New Orleans, literally like more than 75% of the schools were rated at D or F. And now they've gone up basically so that they have maybe, I think it's something like 24 schools or something that still are at a D, and the majority of schools are at A's and B's and some at C's.
And that, so even and on that, obviously the higher the letter grade, it's, you know, the better it is and the more they're hitting criteria, things like reading at age grade level, going on to the next level of school, et cetera.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and also attendance has improved, keeping kids in school, the dropout rate. You know, there's just been a lot of positive things going on there. And the lessons, I think, from New Orleans is a lot of the kind of conventional wisdom that we have about how schools operate traditionally has been upended because, you know, in New Orleans, they had to get a new workforce. And so predominantly they had young teachers with very little experience, lots of Teach for America teachers. And so the number of teachers with 5 years or less experience skyrocketed, and the number of teachers with, say, 20 years experience had plummeted. Mm-hmm. So on the indicator of teacher experience, they had this massive increase in student achievement while they had, you know, falling teacher experience. Similarly, credentialed teachers, like traditional credentials, they had a very low number of traditional credentialed teachers while they were also making this improvement because they had all kinds of people working on temporary credentials that were still trying to meet the criteria.
So this is kind of like, this is like the to serve with love model, right? Where you have a guy, you know, and now that I think about it, almost every, you know, teacher savior movie, and that's, you know, certainly a genre that, you know, gets redone every couple of years. But it's you, so I mean, from that, you would almost, you know, it's, you want new, fresh teachers, even if they don't quite have things down yet. They seem to be, at the very least, they're not a barrier to improvement in student achievement.
That's right. And, you know, another thing with the teaching workforce is they had relatively high turnover at the same time, mm-hmm. and people are always worrying about that. And so they have a lot of teachers coming and going, and the kids still were doing better. And, you know, that's, I think, a sign of right now teachers really get locked in for life, kind of tenure, and they have financial incentives not to leave and move and have mobility in the teacher force. And one thing we've learned from New Orleans is that's not necessarily a bad thing. If teachers are moving around, kids are still learning, and there may be good reasons sorting the teacher force in different ways.
What is the reigning theory of why this stuff might lead to more student achievement? Is it that by having voluntary schools that are attended by people who choose to be there, are they by definition more motivated? Is it that the schools, in order to attract students, are more mission-focused so that the system is designed better than if it's merely residential assignment?
I mean, I think it's both of those things that you just named. And in New Orleans in particular, you know, they have a common app for open enrollment. So it works very much like when you apply to college, where you would have one application and you would list your top three schools. Mm-hmm. And one thing that the data has shown is that, first of all, the number one reason that people list schools that they want is because of student performance. And in New Orleans, you know, kids are still very disadvantaged and the demographics of the population is very low income. And these parents unlike conventional wisdom, are choosing schools based on their performance. And the other thing that's happening is, you know, people always said, oh, well, the most disadvantaged kids would get left behind. Mm-hmm. But under this open enrollment system where they can track everywhere kids go over time, 80% of the kids are getting one of their top three choices for schools, and more than 60% of them are getting their number one choice for schools. And this is looking at the people that are on time with their applications
right.
to go through the open enrollment system. And so, you know, A, parents aren't stupid. They're choosing well for their kids. And B, the system is not discriminating against disadvantaged kids. Everyone is mostly getting to go to a school that they like. And so I think that evidence also kind of upends some of the myths about, you know, you have to have kind of the status quo district, you know,
right.
the government knows best about what parents need, and parents in an open market would never figure it out, which of course for preschool and college, parents and kids are always figuring it out. And it's always been an open question why that wouldn't be true for K-12, that parents couldn't look at information and make decisions.
What took so long? You know, obviously, because of National School Choice Week, I've been thinking a lot about education over the past couple of weeks in preparation for it and, you know, whatnot. But it's almost mind-numbing, like, you know, that we do, I mean, as you said, like, we take for granted what used to be, you know, is now, I guess, is pre-kindergarten or something, but it used to be called nursery school. Yeah, you would figure out which one was available, which one had slots open, which ones were close and were kind of good or creepy. With colleges, you know, at least since the 1970s, when college really became a mass phenomenon, people started picking and choosing among, you know, 4,000 or more colleges and universities. Why did it take so long for us to say, like, oh, yeah, you know, and by the way, maybe the place where people are going to spend 13 years, the vast majority of their, you know, structured education, why wouldn't we also give them a choice?
Yeah. And I do think it just goes to the politics of it that, you know, a few years ago, we released that video called The Machine. And, mm-hmm. you know, still, you know, unfortunately, the status quo and teachers unions and administrators, everyone has a teacher on their street. And, you know, they make these dire predictions about what will happen if we make changes to the system. And, you know, we have ways of picking schools based on real estate in our neighborhoods
mm-hmm.
that for a certain segment of the population has worked relatively well. I mean, yes, there might be other choices available, but if you buy a house in a relatively nice neighborhood, your kids are probably going to go to a relatively safe school
right.
that's as good as most other schools. And so I think just some of the longstanding, you know, property tax funding schools, so that people think of it as a local good and it really mm-hmm. is connected to housing, both
yeah.
in the way we pay for schools. You know, it really is kind of this tradition and structure that has long been established. And then also just that people buy through political contributions, mm-hmm. regulations and laws, right? And for everyone, teachers, students, families, we still have this completely rule-bound system where you can't break the rules in any case. And, you know, if you think about, and I know this is kind of an overused analogy, but I can remember a few years ago when Reason TV was covering like the taxi cab monopoly in DC and the fights broke out and mm-hmm. there didn't seem to be like there would ever be a way away from these monopolies and these medallions.
Right.
And that market's completely collapsed, right, in terms of the monopoly.
Yeah.
And now it's a completely free-for-all open system. And so I do think we're still waiting for, you know, right now we spend about $700 billion a year on education. Still 99% of that money is tied up in a monopoly system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like charter schools, we're at 6%. Vouchers and tax credits, we have 250,000 kids going, maybe. Homeschoolers, we have between 1 and 2 million, depending on what, you know, so we still, of the, you know, millions of kids in education, we're barely scratching the surface.
Right.
And so we haven't found that thing that will break down that monopoly yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these kind of inroads are at the margins. And we're still waiting to, like, you know, maybe it will be Donald Trump, dare
yeah.
I say, or Betsy DeVos or something, that will push some of, and I do think there's going to be a lot of legislation and a lot of growth in school choice moving forward, especially with education savings accounts.
Well, let's talk about that in a second. First, talk a little bit about Betsy DeVos. In her confirmation hearings, she clearly she's never actually operated a vast bureaucracy like the Department of Education. She's never run a school district or a school. And a lot of people are saying, that's immediately disqualifying. Do you buy that? Do you think she's a good pick? And how much does the Secretary of Education set the national mood for the direction of school choice, or rather of education policy?
Right. So like anything, I think there's a lot of hype around her. And, politically, maybe she is a more polarizing figure than some folks. But in terms of what our agenda is, getting more kids into quality schools that is driven by their individual needs, I think she's a great pick. And it's actually a feature to me that she's not caught up in jargon, that she doesn't know the ins and outs of, the testing consortia, mm-hmm. do they measure growth or this or that? I mean, that's part of the problem, right, with the federal direction. Although they only supply about 7% of education funding, they're mandating all kinds of things that schools and states and districts and families have to do in order to get that small amount of funding. So, at the end of the day, the question is, could Betsy DeVos have an innovation fund? I'm not necessarily a huge fan of having, one giant federal school choice program
right.
that was regulated by the feds. But I think right now there's a charter school innovation fund that gives startup funds to individual charter schools that's relatively small, like $250 million or something. But it has enabled literally like hundreds of charter schools to get going with federal dollars. And it really doesn't have very many strings attached beyond what they already have to prove to their state, that they have a viable education model. So I think there's huge potential for Betsy DeVos to do something like that, where you could have a school choice innovation fund that would offer startup money without actually directing the program at the federal level, but offer financial support.
Right.
And I do think block granting things like Title I would be great.
Title I covers school lunch programs?
So Title I is, it's basically the biggest federal education program, and it's basically the money that's connected to disadvantaged students
mm-hmm.
to give them a head start over higher performing or more advantaged kids.
Right.
And, it's been around since the 60s, and it was a Lyndon Johnson program, and it really never has proven that it's given kids a leg up, and it gets several billion dollars a year. And then school districts have to meet literally dozens of regulations to prove that they're doing this or that. But in the end, there's been all this evidence that shows that the schools that are Title I schools, that basically state and local funding, because of the way we pay teachers, that in the end, those kids are getting less money, even with the federal
wow.
influx, and the districts are just wasting that money. So, I think tying that more specifically to the kids would be a positive thing. And I think Betsy DeVos could accomplish those things, and that she could focus on choice-oriented
Yeah, could she say, look, I mean, because this is the way that, both at the K-12 level as well as in higher education, the Department of Education says, look, you're taking a the minute you take a federal dollar, you got to dance to our tune. So could she, really ratchet that up to say, and I'm thinking of there was a study that came out last week about how I think they were school improvement grants, the
right,
school
the
improvement
grant.
Grants program. Yeah, that the Department of Education gave out under Obama was over the course of the period, it was $7 billion. And not only not only did it have no effect, but the Department of Education didn't even track how the grants were actually being used, much less measure them. So it seems there's a fair amount of money there, being spread around. There's a fair amount of rules and dictates that come with that money, but it's mostly just kind of being, poured down the drain as it is.
Right. And in the end, districts and schools have to do all this compliance stuff, but it's not like there's all these examples of when they're out of compliance, if they don't meet some benchmark, that the federal government ever takes the money away from anyone. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though there's like carrot and stick, it's not like, you know, some, say, Compton schools in California that have been low performing for decades, hate to pick on them, but it's true, or Oakland schools. It's not like they've ever lost their Title I money because disadvantaged kids aren't doing better. Like, that's never happened. And Title I would be like the SIG grants. It's this extra money to help low performing kids in both cases. So it does seem like if we put that toward increasing the number of charter schools or increasing the number of experiments with school choice, that we would be losing nothing compared to the status quo. Like, it couldn't be worse than what's happening with those billions of dollars now,
right,
that literally don't meet the expectations or the goals of any of the programs like Title I or SIG. Schools aren't improving, even though they have improvement grants. Disadvantaged kids aren't catching up, even though we're pouring, you know, $8 to $10 billion a year toward that goal.
Do you, in the New Orleans example, you had mentioned that there were a series of things that observations that upend the traditional received wisdom about education. Is that also true in terms of things like per pupil spending or class size? Are there other ways in which the success of New Orleans is, you know, kind of causing people to scratch their heads about these assumed correlations that may not actually be true?
Right. I mean, one thing about New Orleans is that the effect sizes, so not to get too wonky or technical, but on the large studies that have been done, basically they're getting much more student improvement for the bang or the buck under this all charter model than traditional things like class size reduction or investing in universal preschool. And so that's one thing that's so impressive about New Orleans, is for a lot less money than investing in small classes, which is very expensive, and universal preschool, which is very expensive, they're getting these giant effect sizes on student achievement and graduation rates and college attendance. And so, you know, it just makes us question both where we should be spending our research dollars and these large scale investments. This probably will change, but over the last few years, you know, at the state level and at the federal level, investing more and more in early education has been very popular. And yet, you know, if we look at our long-term gains for 17-year-olds on things like the SAT or on the benchmarking, you know, we haven't really seen any improvement since the 1970s in these outcomes. And even graduation rates, you know, districts do all kinds of things to game the numbers. So, for instance, I think there was a story that came out about Los Angeles Unified. They've had this big uptick in graduation rates, and it turns out that like 60% of the improvement is kids that are in recovery programs where they get extra units and they, you know, basically they take algebra in 6 weeks and they show that they now know algebra instead of through a traditional. Now, and, you know, and maybe that's the way to do it. I'm not necessarily ranking on those. I mean, maybe that's evidence that we don't need this traditional high school model at all, but it's not that that 60% graduated high school through a traditional program.
Right. That
and
actually, that
about that,
that opens up a fast, you know, this, I mean, to me, it's always been, you know, an odd feature once I started thinking about education, K through 12 education, and it's the uniformity across the country, across, you know, more than 100,000 school districts, where basically every school is doing the same thing. And I'm just thinking, you know, when my kids learn how to play a video game, you know, they stop doing everything else and they, you know, they live with it for 72 hours or a week and become proficient in it. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, when we have this language immersion classes, when immersion programs, when you're going to go travel to a foreign country, you go for 3 weeks or 6 weeks. you know, it's kind of interesting that we don't have schools that do that, where it's like, okay, you know what, now we're diving deep into algebra, and that's all we're going to be talking about for the next few weeks, and you'll come out with a basic competency in it. That's just a specific example of, you know, it's weird that in all parts of our lives, we're setting up new ways of doing things. And education is still pretty much the same as it was when we were in school and when our parents were in school.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about kids in high school that study for AP tests, you know, if they get like the AP book at Barnes and Noble and they didn't really pay attention the entire class, and then in like a week they use that AP test book and they crunch for, you know, the AP US history exam or something, they probably could have done that, like crunched for 2 weeks and foregone the entire actual class. And, you know, so I do think we're just, again, at the margin starting to see kind of like these flipped classrooms where, you know, you listen to your teacher's lecture and then you work self-paced in the classroom at school and you read the material at home, or, you know, these blended learning models. And I think that touches a little bit on this, but what we really, I think, need to move to, and this is where I think we don't have that what will be the Uber or the Airbnb of the education world yet, of competency-based learning. Because, you know, if I need to learn Excel because I'm trying to do some damn thing in a study, right, I find some template or some tutorial on a YouTube video and I learn it and I do it immediately. And I think more and more we're going to be in life, not that we don't need to learn, you know, longstanding things,
right,
some traditional things, but kind of just in time competency-based learning is a thing. And yeah, it does impact, like your example of your kids in the video games, right? I mean, if you're playing one video game, you master it until you finish the game,
right,
in a lot of cases. And so I think, you know, you master calculus until you finish the game. And do you need like 6 months to do that? Or could you do it in 8 weeks and working at your own speed? And so I think we're still waiting for that to take off in a big way, so that personalized learning that comes from, you know, do I take, you know, a class at MIT online that is a college class, and then, you know, do I go to a yoga den because that's what I want to do for my physical education? You know, we're just so caught up in having to have our instructional services from brick and mortar one place that has this huge, expensive staff. And I know we haven't talked about education savings accounts yet, but I think
let's talk about that, you know, because education savings accounts seem to be, certainly over the past year, they have emerged in a number of states. There have been legal challenges to them, some successful, some not. It seems like education savings accounts are what people in the school choice movement originally talked about, vouchers this way, then it became charter schools. Now it seems to be ESAs. Talk a little bit about what they are and what is the status of their kind of distribution around the country.
Okay. So education savings accounts is very much the idea that parents would get basically a debit card or an account with a certain amount of money in it. So, for example, if you were given $5,000 per year, and then you
this would come from your local school district or the state, be tax money that gets put on a card.
That's right. So it would be tax money that gets put on a card, but the difference would be, instead of going to pay for an individual school, it would go to the parents and they would decide how to use the money towards educational expenses for their students. And right now, the number of ESA programs that are functioning is relatively low. The most longstanding one has been in Arizona, and I think there are around 500 students. And right now in Arizona, it's very specific populations. So I think special education kids, foster kids, kids that grew up on Indian reservations that have some of the lowest performing schools are using them in Arizona right now. And I think their program was passed in 2011. So it's the most longstanding program. And then most of the other programs right now around the country are also for a specific population. But Nevada passed actually a universal education savings account program, and it was under a court injunction. And the first year there were 8,000 families that signed up, and they did have $5,000 that would go to a debit card. And so basically the state ruled that it was constitutional under separation of church and state and Blaine amendments, so you could pick any school, but there was an idiosyncratic funding rule in the Nevada state constitution that said that public schools have to be funded first, and any time you funded education savings accounts, it would be unconstitutional under that provision. And the court agreed with that. So now they've had to come up with a separate funding stream. And in fact, this week, Governor Sandoval announced $60 million in funding for those first 8,000 families that signed up. So it looks like the Nevada ESA program is going to move forward. It's a bummer because it will always have to have a special appropriation right now, because and that opens it up, you know, to the whims of whoever is
so
in power.
So can I ask, though, with the 8,000 families that sign up for it, do they opt out of traditional public schools, or what, you know, or is it on top of, like, could their kids go to the public school, but then would they give the full $5,000 over to the, how does that work?
So they could do that. They could, say, take some classes at a public district or give their full funding. But for so far, most families aren't choosing to do that because there would be really no difference in that than just enrolling in the public school. So right now, the majority of families in Arizona and in Tennessee and a couple of these other small programs are using a combination of private schools, tutoring, online classes, therapeutic services, and there's beginning to be kind of rating systems that would look like Yelp to rate the different service providers, and people are coming up with more formal, kind of like Rate My Professor.
They're getting beyond the hot chili pepper and into more substantive dimensions, I assume.
Right. So you have, you know, a huge combination of things. A lot of parents are just simply choosing private schools and private school tuition. And then you have, you know, your outliers where they have an autistic kid and they respond to kind of horse therapy where they work with horses and they, you know, have horseback riding lessons and they spend time with the animals to, you know, tutoring for specific services like my kid needs help with calculus. And so
with the
so
private
really wide open
with the private school element, then they let's say the private school has, you know, the tuition is $8,000, they might take the $5,000 and pay for, you know, put that towards it and then add $3,000 on top.
That's right. So there's no restriction on parents making their own investments. And on the flip side, you know, if they, it works similar to a medical savings account where if they don't spend all the money, it can roll over. So they could, maybe it will be more expensive to go to spend money on high school. And then if they don't use it for K through 12, any savings that the families have, they can apply that to higher education as well.
Wow.
So it really does become the family's money, and they can, from year to year, they can use the money. So that there's a built-in incentive, right, to find high quality for lower prices and bank some of the money for more expensive education expenses later, like college.
So, well, let's talk about that in terms of, you know, incentivizing consumers of education to become kind of smarter shoppers. You know, one of the things that I've always found interesting about the way that we talk about education is it strikes me as somewhat similar to healthcare, where there's a lot of focus on trying to keep costs down. We kind of assume it's all about, like, how do you meet the demand by reducing costs or making things more efficient and effective. And there's relatively little interest in kind of growing the supply. So in healthcare, you know, during all of the Obamacare stuff, there was very little discussion about saying, you know what, let's open up medical schools and or create more nurse practitioners. Let's drive down prices and increase options and choices and service by flooding the market with new providers. Is there something going on in education that kind of fits that, or will something like educational savings accounts, do you think that will help grow the supply and variety of people who are actually providers of education, the supply rather than just focusing on the demand?
I think there is huge potential for that to happen, because right now there's all kinds of experimentations with kind of small schools or alt schools or budget schools, but it's hard to compete with free. And if there's no money that can flow towards those investment, then you're dependent on, the 8% of people that would choose to not go to a public option. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you open up an education savings account, and certainly in New Orleans, we saw this even just with opening up charter schools, they call New Orleans the Silicon Valley of like educational apps, where you have all these people trying to open up a teacher market to, and Reason's done a video on that phenomenon of selling curriculum that teachers have created or mm-hmm. apps that teachers have created. So to the extent that we don't have this monopoly system that decides for everyone, so if we have education savings accounts, I think on the supply side, there's huge potential. Things like homeschooling co-ops where, 10 families might bind together and they don't actually want to teach the kids themselves. So, they hire graduate students to right. teach, history or calculus,
which is
at a very low cost.
Yeah, which is also a very old model. I mean, I know that people like Henry David Thoreau, the writer of Walden and Civil Disobedience, worked as a tutor. And back in the 19th century, it would have been for wealthier families. But even, when you read the Little House books, I mean, that's how towns, they pooled money together to pay for a teacher for, 15 or 20 kids. So in a weird way, it might, return us to an earlier model of group education.
That's right. Where we could go to kind of, could have, people that want a very large comprehensive school with football teams and debate clubs and drama clubs might choose that, or, something that we would like, those activities could become completely separate. Mm-hmm. So, obviously we have all kinds of private leagues for sports now, but we maintain a public system of sports right next to them. One could hope, right, that in some future with these huge supply of education in schools, that sports would have to make it on their own and appeal to families.
Hey, you're talking to a 3-year varsity letter gainer on soccer. I was the captain of my high school's terrible soccer team. So how dare you suggest that sports are not at the very core. Are there any charter schools that you know of that actually are built around using sports as, kind of the basis of the curricula? I could see how it might, I obviously am much more of a literature guy, and I love the humanities, and I would love to be able to have been able to send my kids to schools that really focused on that kind of stuff rather than being, the high school that my son goes to is essentially, it's a sports complex with a small, kind of Quonset hut of a very expensive Quonset hut of classrooms attached to a football field. But, are there charter schools that are saying, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to structure everything along athletics and physical education.
I think there is a couple of models like that where, they focus on things like kinesiology or physical mm-hmm. fitness. And during the day, they, attach at least, nominally their lectures and their instruction mm-hmm. to these kind of health related and physical sports related themes. And they also use teams and sports. I mean, that hasn't been the dominant model.
Right.
But it seems like there would be a huge demand for that. That if people experimented with that, there would be a ton of people that would really dig that.
And also, going back to my very distant years as a psychology major, Jean Piaget, the Swiss developmental psychologist, he talked a lot about how people's intellectual competency rises when they're more interested in a topic or have mastered it. And I can see totally, you know, taking athletes who might be less interested in things like kinesiology or biology, say, and when you start putting it into a sports context, you know, it might become more, you know, more interesting or appealing to them, as well as potentially creating a career path. There's all sorts of, you know, jobs that are related to, you know, physical activity and physical fitness and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know my daughter took a special class on sports and economics that looked at all the economic themes related to sports and approached it from kind of a free market economic perspective. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a hugely, I mean, there's all kinds of things like this that we just don't do and very well because, you know, if you look at colleges, you have lots and lots of different majors and paths. And it seems like we could do some of that sooner with K-12 education, where kids could opt into things that they like. And, you know, we have a few examples now, like art schools or, you know, schools.
Yeah, performing arts, yeah, math and science or something, yeah.
But it's pretty limited, as it were, at the moment.
So what you had talked about how we're not quite at the, you know, that critical mass where, you know, Uber started out small and then suddenly it exploded everywhere and it really has, you know, it's destroyed the traditional taxi. Well, it hasn't quite destroyed it, but it's massively disrupted the traditional taxi cab model, the cartel model, where a taxi commission that is run by, you know, through politics, defines the supply of cabs and the fares and all of that. What will it take for school choice to get to that kind of Berlin Wall moment where, you know, suddenly things start to collapse? Or can you kind of guess, you know, like when that will happen?
I mean, I'm going to say 20 years from now. I think we still... I think what the big thing has to be is the funding has to be disrupted. And it has to, you know, if we're still at 99% of $700 billion flowing to government stakeholders, we have to break up more of that money and have it follow the child in different ways. And that may mean that the public sector competes in the same way that public universities compete.
Yeah. And often do quite well, actually. I mean, when you look at, I mean, you're in California and the University of California system is, you know, they always have, you know, three or four more universities in the top 30 national universities in the country. Here's a question for you from a kind of libertarian perspective. You know, libertarians like decentralized power, decentralized decision making, decentralized taxing. Is there a case to be made, and this is certainly true in a number of states across the country, where for various reasons their funding mechanisms for education have been found to be unconstitutional according to state constitutions, many of which guarantee a fair and equitable education? Would you support moving to a state-based allotment where you just say, and I realize California has a version of this, but where you say, okay, if we're, you know, we're spending on average $10,000 per student. We are going to take all of that in at the state level and just give everybody in the in this state, you get $10,000, maybe a little bit of an adjustment for, you know, depending on cost of living, you know, where it's more expensive to live in San Francisco than to live in the desert. You know, it's the kids' money. It's the students' money, and they can just spend it any way they want, even though that idea might violate certain kinds of libertarian interests in devolving power to local levels.
I absolutely think that that's what will have to happen. I think property tax right now is one of the biggest barriers to school choice, in that it gives the folks, there's kind of this mythology that because we pay for schools with property tax, we have more local control and there are schools, even though a property tax funding system has not stopped one state or collective bargaining or federal regulation from being implemented. And truly, we don't have local control. And I really do think we have to move to, if you think about how Pell Grants are funded and mm-hmm. what you describe, you know, right now, even when, like in California, as you said, there is one funding formula for the whole state, but property tax still make up a percentage of that. So the state sets the formula. And if you have 100% of the formula funded by your property tax, then you don't get any backfill from the state, and the state backfills, you know, lower property tax areas. And the problem is then that sets up, you know, this kind of us and them scenario where everyone says, well, we pay 100% of our schools, and so these other schools like LA Unified are stealing from us, and it's Robin Hood. And
then you can also, I believe, in California, if a local school district gets a supermajority on a school bond, they can also add on money to the local thing so that, you know, I mean, if part of this is to de-link kind of your zip code and the level or the quality of school that you can do, you know, I mean, wealthy people will always be able to buy their way out of any system. And that's not a bad thing, but if it screws up a system so it makes it really hard for middle class and lower income people to even get provided schools that are worth a damn, that seems pretty problematic.
Absolutely. So, you know, at Reason, our research is really focused on, we have a brief coming out on the state of Texas, which is mm-hmm. under a state lawsuit to make their funding equalized, and the legislature there is tackling it. And, you know, we're calling for them to get rid of the property tax altogether and to use an alternative funding system. And
what would you use, you know, can I ask, in Texas, because Texas, of course, doesn't have a personal income tax. It has pretty high sales taxes, and it has widely varying income taxes. So what would you, you know, what when you say an alternative tax, what would it be?
So that's where it becomes difficult, and it's an open question. But mm-hmm. in Texas, I believe we're proposing as an interim measure that you would do a property tax averaging. So mm-hmm. the state would still collect some of the property tax, and they would set an average rate for everyone. But it would not be based on local wealth. It would just be a straight average. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is we have proposed that it would be based on sales tax or mm-hmm. some other kind of alternative tax that is yet to be named. In a lot of states, they do use property tax, but like the state budget is still already spending sometimes like 50% of the state budget on education.
Right.
So we're just really, I think Vermont is the only state that uses some kind of alternative funding mm-hmm. for their schools. And so we're just kind of getting started. And the pushback, you know, what you have is then you have Republicans saying, well, you just want to destroy suburban schools in America.
Right.
You know, and in reality, yes, right? We don't want school boundaries. We don't want it to be an us against them based on your residence mm-hmm. where you can go to school. So, you know, at the high end, that's absolutely true, but it's nothing personal against suburban districts versus any other kind of district.
Right.
It's just taking away the local wealth advantage, or not just that, that property tax makes it so it really is bound to the geographic area where, you know, if you're looking at college and you are private paying and you get a Pell Grant and you get a college grant from your state, there's no geographic limitation to that. And that's where we have to get to with state funding.
Man,
for
but
education.
that is a political mm-hmm. I mean, it's not even a political football. It's like every sport with a ball and racket and you know, puck thrown in, because I know, you know, just listening to that, I agree with you, and I can remember us having conversations years ago about, you know, the delinking of not just of zip code, but of, you know, your house value, because every realtor will mm-hmm. tell you, depending on where you are, somewhere between 20 to about 40% of the value of your home is dependent on this vague idea that you're in a good or a bad school district. And, you know, so you know that the National Association of Realtors is going to come out hammer and tong against anything that disrupts that, even if it will reset almost automatically. after a switch is made. But you've got that. And, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I live in Ohio. I lived in Texas 20 years ago when the Robin Hood issue about school, you know, the disparities in school funding was coming up. And, I know these states have literally been spending decades trying to get to a point where they can politically implement a court-ordered solution to equalize funding. It's very difficult. Do you think that it's really as, you know, and this sounds somewhat unfair, but it might just be real politic, that as upper-income parents who tend to be more politically connected and certainly more politically powerful, as they start to recognize school choice as an opportunity rather than a threat to their way of life, that that's the flipping point?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, we've been so focused on education quality as a civil right, and school choice is one way to remedy that lack of quality.
Yeah.
But, you know, Steve Barr, who ran Green Dot Public Schools, mm-hmm. that was interviewed, he used to say that what would be success to him is if middle class parents would start enrolling in his schools. And I do think that, you know, if really the core middle class, upper middle class in the United States, they're the ones that they send their kids to school, and they might have a beef about a specific policy or a specific teacher, but on the whole, they don't have a sense of urgency that there's anything wrong with their schools. But we will be at a tipping point when we have enough supply that shows them, you know, that sending their kid to a school that focuses on sports or, you know, is taught with 20 other kids in their peer group, that they actually take advantage of those things mm-hmm. and they find it to be preferable. And I do think we're reaching this point kind of with online education. And, you know, you have these, one of these models, which really calls into question the need for high school at all, is these college, basically college academies, where when you graduate high school, you also have an AA degree. Mm-hmm. And so you take like your junior and senior year of high school at the local community college or at a state university.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think as we have more and more of these different kinds of models that aren't connected to, but it's like which comes first, because in order to have more of these models, you have to disrupt the funding so that those models can be funded, because they're expensive and there's philanthropy only goes so far. And so, you know, we just, again, like every possible thing, whether it's a charter school or a tax credit or a little alt school that mm-hmm. is in Silicon Valley that, you know, focuses on computer science for 10 schools, we have to take it where we can get it. And we have seen huge growth. It's just that when you have a tiny number of charter schools, you know, moving to basically now, I think we're at 3 million kids in charter schools, and that shows 60% growth.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 5 years, that's not going to get us to, you know, the close to 50 million kids that are in school. You know, like we've got to disrupt the funding somehow to increase the supply. And so we have to fight on both sides, the demand and the supply, I think.
Well, sadly, we get the schools we deserve, I suppose, right? Or we get the schools we demand, which is both a blessing and a curse.
Absolutely. And so, you know, and hopefully there's some technological thing or something that somebody thinks of that's going to disrupt it, that gets around all this. I mean, that's what's happened in other sectors like Airbnb.
Right.
It's really the disruptive thing like technology completely circumvents this traditional system. And
well, that's,
so, you know, if we could figure that out, we would make a few dollars, I think.
Well, that was the argument for the for SMOD 2016, the sweet meteor of death, as many people's favored presidential candidate, just something that is truly disruptive and, you know, and gives us a blank sheet of paper to work with.
Absolutely.
We will leave it there. We've been talking with Lisa Snell. She's the director of education research. And thank you so much for talking to us, Lisa.
Thank you, and happy School Choice Week.
Yeah, this is School Choice Week, as we've mentioned a couple of times. Go to schoolchoice.org and get more information This is Friday of School Choice Week, but there's still a couple of days left, and you can go there and plug in your zip code and find out what kind of events are going on and what sorts of people are in your area who are supporting all forms of school choice, from charters to vouchers to tax credit programs to educational savings accounts. It's quite a fascinating group of people and assorted proposals. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Rate and review us while you're there. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.